management jurisdiction. We proposed to go off the international date line, but it's essentially, from an economic point of view, it's essentially the same thing. We proposed limited entry. I think that was the first time that limited entry was ever, that heresy was ever publicly suggested in Alaska. George May. End up getting into the same controversies without really knowing the role the other played. Japan's growing energy requirements and to expand crude oil imports. Japanese industry wants to diversify its energy sources. Say high profit expectations may induce sale of Japanese developed oil within the United States. And we're looking at the situation which existed in the oil market at that time, where because of an import quota, U.S. oil prices were higher than the world market. And so he said, well, what are the Japanese looking for oil here for? It would be ridiculous of them to take oil produced in Alaska directly to Japan. What they would probably do is swap it into the United States for Indonesian crude owned by U.S. refiners. We didn't have much oil to sell at that time. We didn't know how high sulfur and heavy it was and how unacceptable it was going to be or how little of it could be accepted on the West Coast U.S. market. We hadn't anticipated the OPEC price upheaval, which had substantially reduced the growth of demand on the West Coast. Natural gas reserves are among them. Alaska's most promising development assets. Japan's demand for coking coal is strong and growing, but Alaska supplies are uncertain. Japan is a market for metallic ores and concentrates as the basis for the mining boom in Western Canada. The absence of hard rock mining and exports in Alaska are related to the lag in exploration activity and to an obsolescent legal status. And with respect to the hard rock minerals, there have always been people in Alaska who have said that the mining boom is around the corner. This is a vast storehouse of copper, tin, whatever. And there's always some reason to blame the federal government for the lack of this, for stifling this boom. The fact is that so far, with a few exceptions, which were exploited by Kennecott, the McCarthy deposits, that nobody has really found the major non-fuel mineral deposit other than gold that was clearly economic to develop. And the future of hard rock mining in Alaska is very speculative, and I would judge that the B2 situation, the mineral withdrawal of public lands, is one of the least influential. It's important, but one of the least influential considerations. The most promising metallic mineral is copper, but its development for export is precluded by U.S. policy. Domestic livestock production is not expected meet Japan's growing demand for meat products. Japanese firms have shown an interest in Alaska ranch possibilities. Japanese tourism to Alaska is expected to grow rapidly, but the absolute number of tourists will not be great for several years. We projected 25,000 to 30,000 tourists a year in 1977. What it was, and it's probably considerably greater than that. Finally, what do I see for the future? I believe that the export ban on crude oil on Alaska crude oil will be lifted in some way. the logic of it from practically every national interest point of view is so great that the political taboos that attach to the, that were generated during the Alaska pipeline debate will become less and less important. I'm not saying that the ban will be good this year, but the complications of continuing it will be so great that the Far East will be a very major export for Alaska crude oil, and that the making it so will either expand incentives for petroleum developments in Alaska, or to look at the pessimistic side of it from our point of view, maybe optimistic for the world as a whole, that they'll help to offset the downward trend in the price of crude oil and the growing world surplus, in the context of growing world surplus of oil, and the steady erosion of the OPEC price, which is going to occur at least into the mid-1980s. A major bottom fishery will develop. It will develop much faster if we do not, and American enterprise in the bottom fisheries will develop much faster if the restrictions on foreign participation in terms of joint ventures and restriction on selling of raw fish to foreign processors is held to a minimum. The fate of this is in part a political one. It's part a problem of domestic entrepreneurship. It takes domestic initiative and vision to help foreign enterprise put together joint ventures. I think that the native corporations are a very important potential source of this enterprise. On the other hand, bottom fisheries are at this point, joint ventures and bottom fisheries are a highly speculative venture, and they present large dangers for native corporations. I would not suggest that a village corporation in western Alaska put all its eggs and put all its resources, its claims money and mortgages, land, and all for the purpose of going into the fish processing business, because the chances of failure are very substantial. The chances of huge gains are also substantial. Both those considerations ought to be taken into account. The Japanese enterprise will not be the only foreign enterprise involved. As I said, there will be European and probably Korean participation. And mention of Korea again raises another issue. This conference was billed as having to do with relationship China and Japan to rural development in Alaska. I would say a more appropriate focus would be on the Western Pacific generally, and not so much mainland China, at least for a couple decades, but Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, which are growing which are very successful. They are really developing countries as opposed to the countries with stagnant economies we usually call developing countries. And I would add, my hunch is that Thailand and Singapore will, within the foreseeable future, join the economic miracles of Asia with a takeoff to substantial industrialization, diversification. They will develop successfully. So we're we're talking about a potential of a number of other countries with developing very much along the Japanese pattern. And I don't have time to explain what that means, but it's an issue. It's been of great interest to me. Becoming a substantial market and source of exports. Tourism will continue to expand as incomes in Japan and East Asia increase. Alaska will become an increasingly popular destination. And the fate of Anchorage as a stopping point is less certain. It's conceivable that we may lose a substantial part of that trade with the development of longer-range aircraft that could go from, or a route across, a reduction of restrictions for overflying the USSR, so that the higher proportion of the traffic between the Orient and Europe was nonstop. We've seen Fairbanks lost out on its transit stop as a result of the 747SP, which can fly from New York to Tokyo nonstop. Northwest and JAL's nonstop traffic. What happens to Polar Route? I don't know, and I'm not that familiar with what's coming up in aviation technology. Coal and hard rock minerals are speculative. I would say their fate is uncertain. I wouldn't bet on either of them, except in a very location-specific situation now. Finally, the overall picture is for a continuing internationalization of the world economy, despite the present trends toward protectionism. I think it's imperative that the United States, market economies of the Western world are to continue, they're going to have to allow capital to move even more freely, because there's virtually no way that the funds that are piling up in the Middle East can be repatriated, and that we can handle the international financial transactions that result from imports of oil from the Middle East, unless we allow those funds to come back as investment in the developed capitalist countries. And if we keep an open door to Iranian and Arab funds, I can't see the prospect of closing the door to Japanese investment. This is all to say that there have been surprises in the past. It's unique. There have been very few surprises in the last 10 years as to the potential relationship between Alaska and Japan. But I don't pretend to forecast as to what's going to happen to the world as a whole or unforeseen developments either in the U.S. or the Japanese economy.
Thank you, Arlen, for a comparatively and I think characteristically candid presentation on your views on the prospects. I might add that even though you partially abandon the rogues of academia, to manage somehow to maintain the abilities of carrying on rather lengthy discourse, even if extemporaneous. One of the characteristics of Arlen's presentations, which perhaps contribute to his notoriety, is the uncharacteristic academic disarming of what normally go as the qualifications to comments. Arlen tends to tell it like he sees it, doesn't couch many of his observations about the future with numerous footnotes and qualifications. The program at this point is now to shift to essentially a discussant and panel reflections on the same topics that both Dr. Rogers and Dr. Tucson have addressed. Last night at a cocktail party, we tried to define the term discussant in contrast to perhaps a respondent, which is more characteristic of academic proceedings, and decided that perhaps the definition of a discussant was one who was not necessarily refrained to comment on the papers presented, but simply would have to stay within the general ballpark of the topic. Our discussant this morning is an individual who, unlike perhaps contemporary disdain of government bureaucrats, is someone who spent his early life in Alaska, working in the governor's office, moving into the Division of Industrial Development, subsequently becoming the head of the Alaska Trade Office in Tokyo, and consequently the Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development. Perhaps as a testimony to the fact that not all government employees cannot find their way out of the closet, Hugh Gellert left government services in the mid-1960s to become the president of Kenai Lumber Company, a very successful venture.
As we you know, the what that means, and you know that the taking of Indian, you know, that we're taking of Indian land, that we discussed earlier, how there has to be a legal taking, you know, by some governmental act of some type, that you can specify that in the case of Alaska, on the whole, there had been no taking, right? Except in Southeast Alaska, where there had been the creation of, say, the Tongass National Forest. So on the basis of that taking, the Quinkenhaitis received $7.5 million, right? You know, that is what I mean from this, that from our perspective, that is when we got together in the AFN in 1966 and our committee came out and said, this is what we want. We want to be paid for all the land that was taken at that point in time. You know, all the cities and, you know, all the national forest lands, all the federally appropriated lands for national defense or other purposes. We said we want to be paid for that. But and then we said any other lands that haven't been taken, we want to be confirmed in the title, right? That was our initial bargaining position. We said you can keep what you got, you know, and but we want to be paid for it. Everything else that you haven't taken belongs to us, and we want you to give us title to it, right? That was our bargaining, our first bargaining position. Okay, and of course the state, by this I mean the legal situation there was somewhat unclear, wasn't it? Because the federal government through the Congress had presumably conveyed 104 million acres that had not yet been selected and gave them 20 years or 25 years to do it in. And of course, as far as the state was concerned, they were trying to say that that Statehood Act was like a holy piece of paper, right? It could not be violated. It was a contract. And state felt that it was not their problem. This was the federal government's problem, and we should not be involved. The state said that they were not obligated to pay 2% under the Settlement Act. And of course, the state got involved because of the land freeze as well, when we stopped everything, when the Secretary of Interior froze the land from disposition to the state or any other third parties. And of course, so far as the federal government was concerned, you could look at your texts and whatnot, but there are several federal laws that and court decisions that indicated that through the Secretary of Interior, the federal government was the trustee of the Alaska Native people, right? And that they, in effect, had an obligation to deal with this issue. And you can look back at some of the court cases that are listed in your text as well as in the case book. And both the Mary Berry book, the Bob Arnold book. Oh, by the way, Bob Arnold is coming up to speak to our class, not this one, the Tuesday morning one, the next week. Some of you want to sit in on him. He used to work for EMO. So EMO came out with that foundation book, Alaska Native Claims. You can get all that information out of that, as well as those two. Remember, I brought those two manuscripts that are still in. Has anybody ever looked at those? I bet you guys haven't even done that. I put them in reserve at the library. Or at least I had Gary do it, or somebody.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are those manuscripts called? Oh.
Just
put
them up
under Political Science
263. Yeah, it's under Political Science 263, or Gary Anders, or Henley, or somebody. They're two, you know, thick manuscript type that go into.
Very, very and
what? Well, Bob Arnold. You know, remember our texts?
like the Alamo?
I thought this might be something that you could get this number four, sort of a see how much you could do on a particular region that you might be familiar with. You know, you can find out whether or not it has a corporate philosophy, right? How it's structured to do business, you know, where the decision making is, how the board functions, whether they work by committee, investment strategy, just what has been their approach to investments, whether it's been in region, out of region, in what particular areas, whether it's manufacturing or construction or something like that. Management style. Effectiveness in relating to its shareholders and how that's accomplished. Because some do some things, others don't do, you know, some do the minimum, some do maybe quite a bit. Everybody keeps asking about that, so we might as well let somebody study that wants to talk about it. As you can see by Emil's presentation and some of the other people that have spoken, there's no real consensus as to what the Settlement Act means. And how, you know, things are going and how things might go in the future. And I think it's a type of situation that that anybody can see in it what they want to see. You know? And I think what I've tried to do with the course is sort of bring out some of this confusion, right, as to goals, about philosophy and goals, and how people might fit into this milieu that we live with in Alaska. And frankly, there's, I think, among our own people as well, a very minimal amount of knowledge about where this comes from and what it is, among shareholders as well as the public at large. And I think it's important to know as much as you can. Because it is a part of the Alaskan scene, and unfortunately, from my exposure to the higher education, such as it is here, I've not been too impressed with how the university is dealing with the subject. You know? And frankly, that's why you're all mandated to go to this party tonight. Because Dean, whatever her name is, who is it? Do you all communicate with this person?
No.
These people run your lives on a small scale here. And I happen to think that the university could really shine in this particular aspect of life in Alaska, right? What you call Alaska Native Studies is not, to me, for Alaska Natives, it's for Alaskans, right? Because we have to live together. But only the minimum is done. And there's no, as we mentioned earlier, no interaction between campuses, no common planning. And it's an arena in which it could really do some real good things, and I think it's needed. So, yes?
So the feedback is this person in the community working with, as a person in the community working with Bush communities, I decided I wanted more awareness of what was happening, and that's why I took the course. But I got to, you know, some interesting stories in doing research about taking courses, what I should take and what I shouldn't take. So the university hasn't established a great reputation in the community in relation to these programs.
Yeah. Well, it's like anything else. People in positions of authority will take advantage of the confusion among people. Right? I mean, if people don't know what they want, then they're more subject to being led. Is that not true?
I would say it's true.
Excuse me?
I would say it's true.
Yes, okay, well, so, insofar as the university is concerned, if nobody's been telling the system what is needed, and they haven't done anything, then, you know, who's to blame? You know, there's a natural tendency to do nothing unless somebody's kicking you in the butt, right? And so I think it's that time. Well, what? As a matter of fact, yeah. No, I think it's just like what we're going through in our own school district. I've kept sort of advised you about what we're doing. I'm going up to Kotzebue on Wednesday. You know, the consequence of that retreat that our NANA board took out for 2 days out in the country was to set up part of our board to deal, to meet with the school board, and also we're taking our nonprofit, Manila, and we're going to have a meeting of the three boards, right? But George White, who is our superintendent, who has been notorious for fighting with the legal services over just to what extent the villages can participate in their education of children. Anyway, George had dinner with him a couple of times, and
George was a little bit defensive, naturally, since some of my waves had been slapping at him, even though we hadn't talked about education in 15 years, right, or 10 years. But I said, George, I said, I don't blame you for the situation in our school district up there. You know, if our people have been so confused as to be unable to articulate what it is we require in the system, then the fact that you take advantage of that is human. I said, but if our people can get their heads screwed on right, and we decide what it is that we want our children to learn, then you are mandated to deliver that. If you don't, then you got a problem. Right? So there is great insecurity in a situation that one doesn't control. So he didn't want us to meet because he wasn't going to be there. But I said, George, it doesn't matter. And so he said, well, a week or two later, he said, well, I'm not sure if you all should meet because two of the school board members aren't going to be there. I said, well, George, it doesn't matter. You know, because basically I'm not talking to them as representatives of those institutions. So much as we're going to talk about each other and their children and whether or not we expect our people to survive as an identity. So to me, those three individuals are, you know, they're not going to stop it, you know. I mean, if it's going to go, it's going to go, isn't it? It has nothing to do with one or two or three people. And so we'll see how that turns out. Now, you talk about Alaska Native politics. That's, to me, that's an arena that, is going to be, I think, a real emerging issue. You know, once people see the extent to which there is flexibility in that system confirm our identity and to pass on tradition and history and as a means of really doing a better job of making human beings and educating. So, well, but you see, yeah, the REAA, the state-operated school system wasn't much different than the BIA in a sense. I mean, there was a kind of a tone of difference. I mean, you cannot believe the kind of control that the teachers and whatnot have. I mean, I see it right here in this system, right? I mean, people are sort of awed by the system. I mean, I see faculty people kind of scurrying around, scared as hell about the administrators and whether or not they're going to be able to climb up the ladder and all that. And so, likewise, in the rural schools, it's sort of been the same way. The BIA was particularly invulnerable, right? Because they took their orders from Washington, right? Did you know? To right out there. And so any say that the people might have had was almost non-existent. I mean, the most awful teachers just got kind of bicycled around from poor village to poor village who had to put up with it, right? And I think it's going on to some extent now. But our people simply have not taken control like was anticipated. And frankly, I haven't paid much attention to it either. I think there's with the right attitude on the part of our own people as well as the system, the people in the system, I think they could be made effective. But there's been absolutely no creativity of any consequence out there. You know, it's just a job, you know, 9-month job, they get paid well, they they try to do the reading, writing, arithmetic bit. But you know, is anybody reading the Third Wave yet that I recommended? Nobody's reading the Third Wave? No. I just mentioned that one time. Haven't you guys read Future Shock? Huh? Anybody read Future Shock? Well, no, yeah, you read that, you get some idea of what our people in the villages have been going through, but it's by a guy named Talker.
Alvin.
Well, Future Shock was one of his books, and then the other is called The Third Wave. And his thesis is that the first wave was agriculture, the second wave was industrialism, third wave is, I'm still reading the book. it's what's coming on, this wave he says lasted about 10,000 years, starting about 8,000 BC when people began, you know, kind of straightening up and, you know, out of climbing the trees and stuff and out of the hunting and fishing and gathering stage, you know, which is what we've been in, right, out there in the boonies. We are just now reaching the agricultural era after it died here, you know, back about 300 years ago. Some people are still engaging it, but in an industrial sense, right? I mean, it's systematized, right? I mean, that old connection to the earth that the people used to have around which they built their societal structures got destroyed. Well, we're just now learning how to plant up there in my region, you know, and here the industrial age, the second wave is just on its dying legs now. Well, not, you know, maybe go for a while, but she says this industrial age really couldn't survive with the kind of values that were in this stage, right? The large extended families, right? When they started into the industrial era, they had to break down the family and required mass, right? Required mass education, mass peoples, mass cities, mass distribution systems, you know, mass energy systems, right? Which was getting into the earth's resources, right? The non-reproductive type. Up here they used wind, animals, horses, you know, something reusable. And of course we're now at this stage where this infinite resource, infinite energy, is not so infinite, right? And yet we have our whole nations structured around this type of a system, including this mass education, which shows punctuality and obedience, right? Right? You're supposed to say yes all at once. Anyway, so he says that the major conflicts now are really fights over who is going to control the next wave. So in this situation, you're either a part of the old structure. Right now, an age in which you're either trying to hang on, like the Atwood types, right, into this old power structure, or you're busily trying to gain some leverage to control this third wave, which is going to be a totally different type of society, than was up here. All the institutions, the family, you know, the political institutions, the economics are not going to be the same. And so, makes you wonder. Right now, some people are operating under the idea that things are going to kind of carry on as before. So there's nothing strenuous that has to be done, nothing real different that has to be done. We're just going to plan our lives as if we're going to have more of the same. Right?
And of course, other people think that everything's really hopeless,
that there is no real hope, that we are going to run out of energy. We're not going to be able to keep this huge, monstrous machine functioning that requires constant growth, more people, right? More energy, more of this, more of that. So, in either perspective, it's kind of a hopeless situation, right? Either more of the same, where so people do nothing, or cataclysmic change, so it's hopeless to do anything. So, well, in our thinking, in trying to figure out what's best for Alaska, you know, we have to think about that. And of course, in our situation, some of us who work with in the rural areas, we're trying to bridge this gap between, you know, sort of the pre-agricultural era, you know, and this, you know. So we really can't plan a life for what the way it used to be, the way a lot of us grew up off on the country, barely eking out a living right down there with the rest of the animals. The world's not going to be the same. In the meantime, how do we deal with the disorientation, you know, and the disintegration that takes place because of change? Because stability is a sort of a almost a human necessity. Some degree of stability. And the unfortunate thing about people in the villages is that we have been under constant change and constant pressure for a century or more, 200 years in some places, in a world that we didn't control. So you see, I'm trying to point out that we're not much different than each other in reality, except that some people have been under more stress than other people. And particularly if you're dealing with another whole language and a whole different way of looking at life. So, we have to be optimistic, shouldn't we? Otherwise, we'll wonder why what we're doing is sitting here in the room together. I can think of a lot better things to do. Anyway, well, that's all I have now. We have one more period before the final. What should we do next time? Do you guys want more of me or more of somebody else? An elder? Reservations? You want to go back to the Dark Ages? Well, let me think about that. I'll think about that, okay? In the meantime, I remember 7:30.
The Niso Iwa, I think, if to my knowledge, I was traveling with Mr. Ui 2 years ago from the Yukon Institute doing a little research and some filming in the Imanac area, and I found out when I arrived to that village, their cooperative is extensively working with Niso Iwa in the salmon oil and the salmon processing. And there were the people in that village, about 90% of the able workers were working with the Japanese people in that village. And the other thing is some firms in the Bethel area, like in Bethel, the Yukduck Corporation, I presume that they're into the, they're working with some Japanese firms in the fisheries and the salmon roe area. And, you know, I just slightly responded of what Dr. Arlen Tussing has mentioned, that in two terms which I slightly disagree with, that that we shouldn't get into it. I think we should, if I misunderstood you, I would like to be corrected.
Yeah, let me make clear what I meant.
Yeah.
I think that the bottom fisheries offer a great possibility of success for the native corporations. There are some bottom fisheries ventures that won't get off the ground without the participation of native corporations. There's a possibility for very large gains, but it's also a very risky business. And what I said is I did not think that any particular village corporation, or for that matter regional corporation, should put all of its money and all of its assets into the bottom fisheries. That I am sure that there are going to be a number of bottom fisheries ventures that are going to lose a great deal of money. And if a village corporation relies on that one venture for its entire development potential and for all the jobs for its people, processing plant can be the site, the land and the access and the water supply and things like that, because the village corporations have assets other than money. So if it can get a share of the joint venture for contributing resources that wouldn't otherwise be used, that you reduce the risks, you haven't lost your money. Now, I think that it's generally an asset to a village to get a processing plant in, even if the village doesn't own part of it, because almost all of these companies will use local labor if it at all can. Now, I've talked to people in some villages who would like to have the processing plant somewhere away so that the outside cannery workers and all don't cause problems. But I think that's a matter of decision for each village, looking at what kind of life it wants to lead and what it perceives the problems to be.
The other question I have is, from what aspects do you say, why can of a certain village, at times, you know, one of these villages are so large that I'd say that they'd even have more monies than some regions. And you're saying, why can't they just, why is it a high risk to get into the bottom sea fisheries, as we have seen, I've been a fisherman when I was a kid in the Kuskokwim and also in the Naknek areas. I have yet to see one crabber or one fisherman lose out in a single season, even though they say we've lost this season. I have yet to see one. Why do you say it's a high risk area to get into the fisheries and the bottom sea fisheries area?
The salmon fisheries and crab fisheries, the product, the salmon and crab, have a very high price for fish or for crab, and so you can afford to make a lot of mistakes, and the amount of money you have to invest to get into the business at all is considerably smaller. The bottom fish industry is a much more sophisticated manufacturing industry that everything has to come together and click just right. And you can't count on there always being a buyer. Now, if you could the problem of selling your salmon is there's no problem in selling your salmon. Most of the time, there'll be somebody there to buy it. It's certainly true with crab. You know where you're going to do it. Now, if the processor who's buying your fish shuts down, and the bottom fish, your boat is worthless, and all your effort. And the amount of money you've got to put into it is much greater. The value of the fish when you sell it. If you're selling fish for 6 cents a pound, and some overrun in operating costs can make you go broke. Well, that's not the case with salmon crab. So I'd say the bottom fish. I think there's a tendency to assume because the salmon fishery and the crab fishery is such a money machine, and that almost anybody can make some money. That's true of bottom fisheries, and I don't think that's. I expect that we're going to see a lot of bottom fishery ventures that are unsuccessful. And there's going to be a lot of trial and error. It's an absolutely new industry. We've had salmon and crab here for a long time. The first few king crab ventures, when the king crab industry started developing here, there were quite a number of failures there too. It's not a guaranteed money-making machine. Now, on the other hand, those who are successful can be very, very, very successful because in total there'd be a lot of money involved.
Matthew, I wonder if I could ask a question that was asked of me last night by one of our visitors. And essentially it was, what kind of development would native rural Alaska like to see? That is, are they displeased with what's happening now? Are they looking for lots of development activity? As a member of the corporation, I'm sure you address that and find to set out the goals of Chilista Corporation.
Yeah.
Could you just
see this broad question to ask? In many of it depends on the villages you go to, or you know the area. The Chilista region is so vast that in each area there'd be some villages close to knit together that they want to see some sort of development in the fisheries and in anything that will benefit their area. But it's, and in another part of the region I travel to, they do not want to do anything. They said, let's just keep quiet right now. It's the basic truth, you know. It depends of what area you get into.
Chuck, I wonder if you'd like to make a few comments. You've been deferred to by those who are timidly talking about the future of mining in Alaska, and it's always held out as this promise of the future. I wonder if you could share with us some of your.
Yeah, I'd like to try to respond to that, and I guess I. Just based on my own experience, I have to agree that it's uncertain. But because I've stayed in the business, I at least have to be semi-optimistic in what is going to happen. I think George Rogers' remarks that timing is critical. That's a very important thing. And besides timing, I think the context that he had it in was the availability of capital or market, but also the areas of timing on technical knowledge, on labor force, on infrastructure, things that are problems for all of Alaska and other areas, and tend to come back in making minerals and underwriting business. However, there's a few things that have happened, and I think that would serve to update the views of Arlen in the late 60s. One thing that exploration did take off in Alaska, and that in the last few years, since about 1965, why we found deposits which are very large and very rich. And these deposits, there's at least a few, maybe on the order of 10 to 15 deposits, which on paper anyway, can yield a profit, even considering the environmental costs and the infrastructure costs, and what's looked to be developable. There's a certain a list, and of course, the most important commodities are mineral commodities are oil and gas. And then probably in terms of overall Alaska potential, then you have to say coal. Well, then there's a whole series of metallic commodities which appear to be at least possibly developable in Alaska. And these are new deposits. But then in the context of what we're talking about, some of the things that we have in Alaska are also available in Asia. So in the context of this particular meeting, maybe we're not talking about the same things. But the things that I see as being potential at certain specific sites are copper, molybdenum, zinc, lead, tin, nickel, fluorite, and gold and silver. Well, of those, and then there's a bunch of things which are more speculative. Of those, why it appears that molybdenum and fluorite and then going back to coal are things that would definitely be needed in Asian markets, but which are not present abundantly in Indonesia or Malaysia or Korea or something like that. And then the general industrial metals like copper, lead, zinc, I think those things they're open market type things, and Alaska may be important as a source for these things, but it's not going to be a sole source, or it's not going to be a specific metal. But I do think that these things could come along, and they could come along within the next 10 or 15 years. I can't resist commenting a little bit about D2. I think you'd have to say that D2 could be very detrimental, for one thing, because of the site-specific nature of a mineral deposit. If, in fact, a viable mineral deposit is on D2 land, well, then it's a significant impact. The general impacts of D2 that tend to inhibit mineral development would be the problems with access, accessibility, and then on the general availability of exploration, the exploration climate of the state, it would tend to slow things down. As far as rural impact, obviously, that's where mining would happen in Alaska. And while there's a great impetus right now for renewable resources, there are parts of Alaska which do not have a significant renewable resource base, but appear to be fairly well endowed with minerals. And so it can be important to the rural economy. And I think that it can make some contribution to balance of trade and certain specific mineral needs for Asian countries. These deposits, besides the exploration activity, and maybe partly because of this other thing, we've learned a great deal about the geology of Alaska in the last 20 years. Part of it, we've learned that we have a lot older rocks than we thought that ever existed here. We know that we now have quite a few Precambrian rocks. We know that we have the type of deposit called massive sulfides, and these are very rich, very concentrated deposits. They have them in Japan, the Kuroko type deposit. But one deposit in the Brooks Range, for example, contains 3.5 times the amount of copper that came out of the Kennecott deposit, which was considered to be the richest single copper deposit ever found. And that's a much more advantageous mining situation. So I think that optimistically, Alaska will have a mining industry, and perhaps it can contribute to the rural environment in parts of Alaska and possibly to Asian trade.
As I mentioned in the introductions of the panelists, we had somewhat a cross-section of representation. And both in the business community as well as having served in public service, Frank Murkowski has been on sort of both sides of the table as a negotiator from state perspective, trying to capture as much of the wealth and resource rent as possible. And also is currently now on the other side, serving in the business community, negotiating oftentimes with the state, or trying to serve as a middleman in fostering private developments in Alaska. Frank, would you like to share with us your comments?
I'm going to stand up because I'm tired of sitting down, as I'm sure most of you are. It's been an interesting but rather long morning, so I won't be very long, as I see I'm the last of the commentators this morning. I'd like to make a few comments, though, that I feel are pertinent regarding the policy that we've had with regard to development of rural Alaska, and I use the terminology pretty loosely because I consider every area, with the exception perhaps of Anchorage and to some extent Fairbanks, pretty rural. It classifies it rural by various U.S. government agencies, making various types of aid available for various types of local projects and so forth. But I think if we go back, we find that we've maintained a very hot and cold philosophy officially, either philosophy or development climate towards resource development based on the importation of Japanese capital. If you recall, and all the speakers today have addressed themselves in the timber area, when the first development was designed, if you will, and it was designed, as I understand, a portion of it was the actual peace pact signed between Japan and the United States by MacArthur, at which time consideration was realistically given of a timber sale in southeastern Alaska to aid the Japanese government in their recovery. That's pretty significant from a historical standpoint, that it actually went back to a peace pact, in which, of course, there are a lot of other negotiations going on other than a contemplated pulp mill in Sitka, Alaska, which is what has become a result. But respect. The fact remains, Alaska was desperate for jobs at that time in our history. We encouraged that development. It was encouraged not only by our government, but our state government, by our chief forester, I think at that time, Frank Heintzelman, because it meant jobs for Alaska. And Japan was in need of fiber. So as a consequence, we saw that development, which resulted in a lot of jobs, resulted in a tax base for that community, resulted in the expansion of the logging, tugboats, and the additional support industries necessary to support the timber industry. And we've seen that expand somewhat into now a significant lumber market, which previously, with the exception of some of our better spruce, we had no market for our hemlock. This was a market that was developed over a long period of time in Japan to the point where we developed the baby squares and so forth. But it took a long time. It wasn't a matter of opening up our forest and the Japanese suddenly coming in and saying, yeah, you're the true path to heaven. You've got everything we need. They had to build up the market and the acceptance. It took a long time, but it was successful. And at that particular time, the Japanese, as I understand it, my association, were reluctant to deal with the Russians. The Russians are much closer. They have a similar species of timber as we have in southeastern Alaska, but they just weren't ready to move comfortably and market with the Russians. That's beginning to change, as Hugh indicated, but by the same token, we've seen an expansion of the movement of that industry from out of southeastern Alaska up to western Alaska. We've seen a chip development over in the Taiyonik area, which is subject to the market conditions in Japan, but there's been a movement out, general movement northward into Icy Bay, Jackaloff Bay, Seward. There's been discussion of interior timber. So it's moving, and I agree with most of the speakers that it's perhaps it isn't going to move proportionally as fast as it did the first few years of its development. But I point out that at the time it came in, we had a very clear, decisive policy on development. We encouraged development in an industry resource potential that really had virtually no development. Now, if you talk to various people involved in the pulp mills, they'll say that they're up to their sustained yield on their timber allotments, and to confuse the issue, of course, is the D2 land application as far as it applies to the various forests in Alaska. So again, we've gone in the timber industry from let's go, let's make it happen to, well, let's wait and see. We've lost, as you know, one major pulp mill in Juneau for obvious reasons. A tremendous environmental effort that was totally successful to prohibit the development of the timber resource from Admiralty Island. And if you move on to the fishing industry, which has been thoroughly covered by most of the speakers, there's one thing that I think is apparent that hasn't been touched on, and that's the fisheries we see developing in Western Alaska today. And I would venture to say that development was aided substantially by Japanese interests, which were first evidenced in Bethel when the freezer ships were brought out in front of the area, and the question was who should the native fishermen be allowed to sell to the people who give them a higher price, namely the Japanese or the Americans, and there was a great deal of deliberation and so forth. But if you go up to Kotzebue today, you go to Unalakleet, you go to Nome, where you at one time had freezer ships ready to buy, you now have a developed industry, and they're flying fish out of there by the Hercules aircraft day after day after day. And there is a substantial market that's developed in those areas that really didn't exist, and we really have the Japanese to thank because they started it all. But again, it's moved from a point where the Japanese were accepted, and kind of now they're not accepted anymore because of the governmental political aspect and a clear defined policy regarding foreign capital development in Alaska. I would venture to say that if you tried to put an LNG shipment contract of the magnitude that exists between Tokyo Gas and Electric and the Kenai plant today, it'd never happen because politics isn't right. The politics in the future isn't right. Arlen talked about the export of our excess oil to Japan. Obviously, it makes sense. Trade off the Venezuelan oil and bring that into the East Coast of the United States. Just, you know, you cut everybody's costs, but again, the politics is wrong. The Japanese come over here and they're interested in our agricultural potential, which hasn't been touched on. We have no policy for land development. If you're going to develop agriculture in Alaska, you're going to have to look to the Pacific Rim countries for your market. That infrastructure has to be established. But more important, the land has to be made available to someone in large enough tracts to be economically feasible. And that isn't done. And the administration and the governmental bodies in the state of Alaska have not directly addressed that. You're going to have to lease enough land to Japanese capital, or you're going to have to sell enough. You're not going to necessarily bring in Japanese labor by any means, because the farming will be high degree of technology involved. But I point this again to relate to you the lack of a clear defined development policy within the state towards bringing Japanese capital or capital from the Pacific Rim countries into rural Alaska. And until that happens, why, I don't think you're going to see any significant development, because there's just too much confusion, which is evidenced back as far as the Clukwan interest in iron ore down in Haines, south of Juneau, a significant iron ore deposit, but the the wherewithal of trying to streamline as to whether or not this development is wanted is significantly lacking. Those of you with longer memories will recall that 5 or 6 years ago, we had virtually every Japanese trading company in residence in Alaska. Today, there might be one, I don't recall. But there was a result. We asked them to come over. We invited them. And when they got here, there was nothing to do. There was nothing virtually to sell because it took them a while to understand the infrastructure. And then we had no clear, defined policy. And I would conclude my remarks by suggesting that we begin at the beginning and find out what our true attitudes are. And I would also invite this for the consideration of the regional corporations as to how much, if any, Japanese capital we want. And I eliminate China because I think it's impractical for consideration at this time, maybe in decades, but not at this time. And if we do want Japanese investment, how are we going to encourage it to happen? If you relate to the specifics, and I was interested in some of the comments regarding the gentleman from the Calista Corporation, the Japanese process the salmon eggs, the roe, in a certain way because they know how it's done and they have a particular knowledge of that particular market, and that's the way it has to be. It's the same in the herring egg industry where they pick the herring egg off the kelp, and it's got to be packaged in a certain way. I've been over the west coast of Prince of Wales when they first started that, and you'd be dragging for the kelp. You'd throw it in the bottom of the skiff, and it'd mix with the outboard oil and all that. Well, obviously, the Japanese didn't want that. They want high quality, stay controlled. So, frankly, in the experience I've seen, the reason the Japanese technicians are over here is because our labor force is not geared to sit there and run salmon eggs through a screen with their hand. They're just not geared to that. And I venture to say our native people aren't geared to that. They don't want to do that kind of a job. They want to do something else. That's why these people exist. I conclude my remarks. Thank you.
We have a few minutes before recessing for the lunch break, and we have a floating microphone, which is actually in someone's hand rather than floating. Are there any questions in the audience you'd like to address to one or two? And I'll try to, if you would, try to limit your, if it's a question, we try to field it. If it's a comment, please try to limit it to just a minute or two. I think you can just speak into it, and it should
all right.
Be live.
Thank you. I just have a comment. And it's related to a couple of things that were said. I think Mr. Tusing and Mr. Jellert referred to Dr. Cutler in the beginning mentioned we urbanites are in a position of discussing the development of the ruralites. And he said whether they wish or not. And I think that's something we should be cautious of. I think we should respect those who live in the rural areas and assist them rather than push them. But there's another element, or the other end of a seesaw in that regard, and I find myself in Alaska discovering the federal government, and which I don't call a federal government anymore. I call a national government because they seem to dictate from the top rather than form a federation or a trust government coordinating all the states. I think D2, relative to the land masses involved, are not as critical an issue as the philosophy of D2. Because the philosophy of D2 seems to be express the philosophy of Alexander Hamilton, which was to have a very strong federal centralized government, and had many debates with Jefferson about the development of this country. And I think that the D2 issue is very germane because it does indicate that we have to get permission of how to spend our lives and our money. Here we might be planning the development of Alaska, but when we come to a decision, we have to go and have permission given to us before we can even trade with the Japanese. I think that's a little bit obscene. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. There was another question here. Would you identify yourself for the group, please?
I think Matthew Nicolai brought into focus here a prime question that is in the minds of many Alaskans. We have, our company has 51 flights weekly transiting Alaska, moving great volumes of seafood both westward to Asia and south to lower 48. And the question is in the minds of many Alaskans in the fishery industry as to why is so much of the industry financed by the Japanese interest. Dr. Tussing's statement that the fishing industry is a high-risk industry is not a supportable statement. The problem arises from the fact that the federal, state lending agencies and the Alaska Banking Fraternity and the Lower 48 Banking Fraternity have not found any or evidenced any interest in the development of the fishery, and certainly we have no environmental problem and we have no D2 problem and we're not crossing streams or polluting waters. And I think that if, as an outgrowth of this conference, there should be a conference established within the framework of this organization to examine ways and means in which American capital and American business entrepreneurs can involve themselves in the fishery and associate themselves with the native corporations and possibly answer some of the questions that Mr. Nicolai addressed himself to. The Aleut Corporation will show several million-dollar profit from the operation of their crab processing plant and the Aleut Princess and the Aleut Pride. Crystal Bay Native Corporation will have a $6 or $8 million profit from Peter Pan plant newly going at King Cove, and I hope that I am pleased to be some interest manifested within the framework of our state, federal, and local lending agencies to see if there is not some way that they can participate in developing a program to finance the individual entrepreneur or the village corporation or the native corporation or the ordinary fisherman. Now, they've been forced to turn to overseas expertise and capital because of the lack of interest. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Are there any other comments before we break for lunch?
A question, as Frank pointed out, there's been no discussion really about Steve DeLisio. I'm an attorney. There's been an awful lot of discussion about a lot of other facets except agriculture. And of course, agriculture in its many facets, farming the seas. The Japanese have done a tremendous amount of pioneering in that area. And one wonders what sort of an interest there is among regional corporations, about the state government and so on, in developing some sort of a partnership where we mine their technology, for example, and how to farm the seas with aquatic plants as well as sea animals. What about agriculture involving not just the tilling of the land, but the herding of animals, bison, musk oxen, reindeer, the tremendous interest in the Orient, for example, in reindeer horn or antlers. And, of course, the talk here that's been discussed about protein from meat. What sort of interest or what sort of future potential do we have, for example, in developing the farming of fur-bearing animals, perhaps even the sea otter? Now, I don't know what technology it takes to raise sea otter, if it can be done in captivity, or mink and ermine and all of these other kinds of animals, which we know there's a market for. What about the farming of fur seals? Now, we have the Pribilof Island project, and that's of a rather limited scope. But what kind of interest, what kind of potential, what kind of things does it take? What kind of potential partnership is there of combining the technology that that our neighbors across the ocean have developed that we've never even looked into? What sort of future is there for that, rather than some of these more traditional, or perhaps in addition to some of the more traditional ideas of economic development?
Thank you. You raised a whole series of potential questions. I think it would be difficult in the last 2 minutes of this morning session to try to address the questions of cottage industry development or raising of fur-bearing animals and so forth. In the program tomorrow, however, there is an agenda item where I think Bob Palmer from the governor's office is going to talk specifically about agricultural development prospects in relation to exchanges with Japan. I would only make one comment in response, that your observation that there may be relatively small-scale types of enterprises, such as reindeer herding, can be a very beneficial kind of development, even though it affects a relatively small number of people. The settlements in Alaska in the rural areas are still quite small and sparsely settled, and relatively small-scale economic projects can have a very substantial effect on these rural settlements. Any other comments before we break for lunch? One more? I'll take one more question, then we'll
My name is Robert Sutton. Here is I study of Japanese food, Alaska, probably that was the major study done, you know. And I took all and everything, and there was, you know, big increase of Japanese food in 1973. The tourism went down because of and the Japanese were, you know, just visited Alaska for average of 3 days. And then a lot of people, you know, were interested in developing tourism in the rural areas, but there was really no design or policy from the state of Alaska, you know. And so that's one of the major reasons that I just agree with most of what he said. If everybody talks about bringing Japanese capital to the state of Alaska, nobody looks at segment by segment, nobody does the study, and everybody talks about it, that's about it.
I'd make just two concluding remarks on the panel session this morning that pertain to the subsequent sessions that will follow. First, two observations for those of you who are serving as guest speakers to Alaska. Given the kind of historical review that George Rogers gave us in his presentation this morning, I would just try to emphasize that what's occurring in terms of the basic political economy of Alaska is essentially the state of Alaska and its various subdivisions are attempting to capture the maximum amount of economic rent or the sale of its resources, so that much of the time and energy is devoted to trying to maximize the amount of dollars that the state will receive from the development of these resources And correspondingly, we're seeing increasingly the same kind of politics operating at the rural areas. That is, what's going on with the North Slope and trying to maximize its tax levies to capture as much as it possibly can the rent of the economic development occurring on the North Slope is not a great deal different from what the state's doing as a whole. Local communities are concerned about trying to capture the value of a non-renewable resource for their own benefit. So in terms of what's happening in the state of Alaska in a political economic sense, I think it's important to share with our outside speakers that this kind of historical development is seeing a shift from a quasi-colonial pattern to one in which we're seeing an increasing amount of quasi-nationalistic efforts, both by the state of Alaska as well as some of its smaller subdivisions. The other issue that's occurring within the state is essentially a related question, and that is the distribution question. In the past, as George had mentioned, those who were the beneficiaries of the resource developments were not necessarily the local people, and more often than not, local people sometimes served as the persons who were adversely affected. Some of the resource developments we're talking about now, largely in oil and gas and mining, did not necessarily have adverse effects on the traditional resource base of the communities, but they may. And one of the issues that's been preoccupying a lot of public attention has been on the question of impacts. And I would expect that question of impacts is really concerned with the question of who gains and who benefits. And that political issue and economic issue will persist over time as well. Those are the two comments I have for our out-of-state guests. For those of you who are attending the conference, I'd make two other observations that try to relate the discussions this morning to the discussions that will follow. For those of you who've been students of business, you're aware of the three M's of business success: the markets, the management, and the money. The state of Alaska has the money. It's going to have a fairly substantial amount of capital available. What Arlen had suggested was we do have problems with markets and management. It was discussed that Japan represents a very substantial market for much of Alaska's resources. Some of the people that we've invited from the outside are experts in international economics, and I think they'll show for you how the Japanese markets really play a part in the international marketplace. And so much of Alaska's resource developments will not necessarily be dependent upon Japan's market, but upon the international markets for the resources that we'll be talking about. And I'm sure they'll share with you their analyses of the kinds of patterns that they anticipate in the future. The second area that relates to management, and that is to the extent that joint ventures represent an opportunity for American businessmen or Alaskan businessmen to enter into cooperative ventures with foreign trade organizations that have experience in integrated industries. The question is, well, how do specifically the Japanese approach joint ventures? How do they operate as an integrated industry? And to what extent can we as potential partners in a joint venture with Japanese trading companies or industrial concerns know how they operate? And we have several experts who are with us at the conference who know a great deal about the integrated economic strategies of Japan, and they'll be sharing those with us too. Lunch is going to be served at the pub downstairs on your left, and the tickets that you've been furnished and the packets and so forth will be collected at the door. Thank you very much for joining us in the morning session. We'll look forward to you this afternoon.